turn tonight to the book of Job, book of Job, chapter 2, and we'd like to read verses 9 and verse 10. Job 2, verses 9 and verse 10. Then said his wife unto him, "Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die." And he said unto her, "Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God? And shall we not receive evil? In all this, did not Job sin with his lips?" What is recorded in these two verses is the reaction and response of Job's wife to the terrible and horrific, excruciating, and shocking events or sequence of events that had occurred in their family. Verse 10, we see Job's reaction to her. By way of background, leading up to the text, if we turn over to the book of Job, chapter 1, we learn several things. We know that Job and his wife had 10 children. We see that in verse 2. 7 daughters, or 7 sons, and 3 daughters. They also had great wealth. Verse 3 says that his substance was 7,000 sheep. That may not mean much to you and I, but in those days it meant a lot. 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses. We're also told that they had a very great household. He was considered the greatest man of all the East. Then in verses 9 through 11, and again in chapter 2 and verse 5, we see that Satan challenges God. He tells God that the only reason that Job serves you is because you've blessed him. And you've put this hedge about him where I can't get to him. But if you were to take away, or if you were to allow me to take away everything that he has, Job would curse you. That didn't work in chapter 1. Satan tried again in chapter 2. And he said, if you were to allow me to take away his health, I know that he would curse or he would blaspheme you. Now, from that, we learn that it is the desire of Satan to get the people of God to curse or to blaspheme the Lord. We also learn that in both cases, there in chapter 1 and chapter 2, God permitted Satan to do something. In verse 12 of chapter 1, "And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he hath," that is, materially, "is in thy power." God gave Satan permission to attack Job. Chapter 2, in verse 6, he said, "And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, he is in thine hand," that is, his health. So we see that God permitted Satan to attack Job. Also, we see in both cases that God limits the trial. This is something we ought to always be mindful of, something that we ought to always be thankful of, no matter how bad you think it is. God limits your trial. In Job 1 and verse 12, "And the Lord said unto Satan, only upon himself put forth not thine hand." You can take away everything he has, but you're not allowed to touch him physically. Then in chapter 2, we see that again the request of Satan was to attack his health. And in verse 6, "The Lord said unto Satan, but save or spare his life." In other words, you can take away his health, but you cannot take away his life. In both cases, there was a limit to the trial. Now, the Bible very plainly teaches that trials are tests. And we see that all of this that we've referred to thus far teaches that Satan has an evil intent in all trials. In all trials, Satan has an evil intent. In all trials, Satan has a goal. And that goal is to get the people of God to blaspheme the Lord. We also learn from all of this that we've referred to thus far that God is in absolute control of all things, including what the devil does. Satan cannot blink an eye unless God gives him permission to do so. In Job chapter 1, we read of a day of unexpected suffering. A day of unexplained suffering. I mean, who can explain what happened that day in Job chapter 1 other than, well, it's the Lord's will? Well, we know that. But what transpired there, the suffering that transpired, cannot be explained. Satan began his assaults on Job when his 10 children were dining at the eldest son's house. We see that in verse 13 of chapter 1. "And there was a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And on that day, Satan would use human and natural forces in his attack upon Job. He used a Sabaean attack in verse 15. "And the Sabaeans fell upon them." In verse 16, he used fire. We read, "The fire of God is fallen from heaven." In verse 17, he used the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans made out three bands. And in verse 19, he used the wind to smite the house of the oldest son. We read in verse 13, "And there was a day." And there was a day. And I believe that that day probably started out like every other day in Job's life. But it would be a day unlike any other day that Job would ever experience. It would be a day that would drastically change Job and his wife's way of living. I believe it would be a day that would drastically change Job and his wife's way of thinking, their way of looking at things. I don't believe they ever looked at things the same way again. They had different perspectives. And on this particular day, in a very short time span, a godly man and his wife would be immersed in a world of sorrow. Sorrow that cannot even be explained. There was a day. And though it started out like any other day, it was a day that would bring disaster. It was a day that would bring catastrophe. It was a day, humanly speaking, that would bring tragedy. It would be a day that would be filled with unimaginable pain. It would be a day that would be filled with unimaginable agony. But it is important, because I believe many fail here, it is important to recognize that all that transpired on that day not only affected Job, don't forget Job's wife. Don't forget Job's wife. In Job chapter 1, we are told of the tragic, catastrophic events of that day. Perhaps Job is out on his patio drinking tea, I don't know. And he sees a messenger. One of his servants comes running in. His clothes are wet, sweat is running down his face. He's gasping for breath. And he has this panic-stricken look upon his face. And with hysteria, he says to Job, "Job, we were working in the fields, and the Sabaeans came and took away the 500 yoke of oxen. They took away the 500 donkeys, and they have brutally murdered the servants, and I'm the only one that escaped." And we read in verse 16, "While he was yet speaking," while this servant was still bringing his news, here comes another. He also has a look of panic upon his face. He also says to Job with hysteria in his voice, "Job, fire came down and burned up 7,000 sheep and all the servants that tended to them. They've all been killed, and I'm the only one." While he was speaking, another messenger comes, again gasping for breath, again this panic-stricken look upon his face, saying, "Job, the Chaldeans have attacked. And they have stolen the 3,000 camels, and they have killed the servants with the sword, and I'm the only one that has escaped." And while this servant is speaking, here comes the fourth. And this man has a look of sheer horror on his face. And I imagine he had difficulty in even getting the words out. He said, "Job, your 7 sons and 3 daughters," perhaps he named them, I don't know, "but your 7 sons and 3 daughters, they were all at your oldest son's house when all of a sudden a powerful wind swooped down and blew down the house. Job, they're all dead. They're all dead." Notice verse 19. Down toward the end of that verse, notice those words, "And they are dead." And they are dead. our debt. In a matter of minutes, perhaps a few hours, Job and Job's wife lost their possessions. By so doing, they lost their livelihood. With the exception of four servants, they lost all their servants. And I imagine because of the character of Job, Job treated his servants very well. And I imagine he knew them by name. With the exception of four, the four that delivered the messages, they're all gone. And worst of all, their seven sons and three daughters are dead. And there was a day. A day of overwhelming suffering. A day of overwhelming grief. A day of overwhelming sorrow. A day that Job and his wife would never get over. Oh, they would get beyond it. But they would never, ever completely get over this day. This was a day that changed the rest of their life. We read in verse 22 of chapter 1. Notice the first three words. In all this. In all this. And you can't even begin to imagine all that is included in those words. In all this. It not only includes them losing their possessions and them losing their children. It includes all the emotions, all the sorrow, all the pain that they experienced in all of this. In chapter 2, we read of another day. Perhaps most people assume it was the very next day. I think that's perhaps a wrong assumption, but perhaps this was a day after the burying of their children. But on this particular day, we see that Satan, in verse 7, smote Job. That is, Satan attacked Job. Still suffering from what has already transpired, Satan attacks Job with sore. And that word sore means painful, hurting, aching, stinging, itching, excruciating boils, pus-filled swellings on the skin. And these were from the sole or the bottom of his feet to the crown or to the top of his head. So Job, in addition to his inward heartache, to his inward sorrow and grief, is now filled with physical discomfort, physical pain, torment, and misery. And we read in verse 8 of chapter 2 that Job sat down among the ashes. Now, anytime you see ashes, this isn't rocket science, anytime you see ashes, there was a previous fire. Job sat down in the ashes. I've heard people preach, I think they're way off, but I've heard them preach, he sat down in the ashes of the house that was burned. I don't believe that's what it's referring to. I believe this goes back to chapter 1, verse 5. And it was so When the days of their fasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. Job had a practice. Every day, he would go out and he would offer sacrifice. Job had a place. And he would go to that place and he would carry his lamb to that place. He would cut the throat of that lamb, drain the blood from the lamb's body, dissect the lamb, stand back and offer the lamb to God, and raise his hands in praise to God. And there came a day in chapter 1 when Job lost all of his material blessings, lost all of his children. Now in chapter 2, he has lost his health. And what did Job do? He went out to his place where he had made so many offerings in the past. And he sat down among the ashes. And we can hear him crying to God, God, I don't know what you're doing. I have no idea what you're doing. But you've been so good to me. You've never let me down. You've never left me. God, I don't understand. But I need you today. I need you right now. I've never needed you but more than I do right now. God, you've got to help me. I believe that's what was transpiring as Job sat in the ashes. That brings us to our text. And in this message, we want to consider Job's wife. There he is sitting in the ashes. And she comes and she speaks to him. Our subject this evening is simply Job's wife. First of all, consider these words of Job's wife. Then said his wife unto him, dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die. What she is saying is, Job, are you still going to worship? Are you still going to serve God? And I believe that, again, is further evidence that he's sitting in the ashes of his offerings and he's praising God and he's worshiping God. And she says, Job, are you still going to worship him? Are you still going to serve him? Job, can't you see? Can't you see we don't have anything left? Everything is gone. Job, we have nothing to live for. And how many messages we have heard lambasting Job's wife because of these words? How many times she has been treated so harshly because of these words? How many wrong conclusions have been jumped to concerning her because of these words? You listen the most. I have never heard a message strictly on Job's wife, but you listen to people who mention Job's wife, and they paint her, all because of these words, as an evil and wicked woman, all because of what she said at this time. But in this message, I want to view her from a different angle. I want to say, first of all, that I do not believe that Job's wife was an evil and wicked woman. We read concerning Job in Job 1 and verse 1 and also in verse 8 that Job himself was perfect, that is, he was blameless. It also goes on to say that he was upright, that is, he was right spiritually. He was one that feared God. He was one that reverenced God, and he eschewed evil. That is, he hated sin, and he abstained from it. You say, well, what does that have to do with Job's wife? Well, I find it hard to believe that a man of such character would marry an evil and wicked woman. It just seems to me that Job would have married a godly woman. And I believe Job's wife was godly. Certainly she wasn't here in chapter 2 and verse 9. Now, as we consider this woman, dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die. We are in no way condoning what she said. She should not have said what she said. What she said was absolutely wrong. What she said was inconsistent with devotion to God. But I ask you this question: is she an evil and wicked woman? And before you say yes, look at what she said. Have we not all, in the midst of pressure, said things that we should not have said? Have we not all, in the midst of pressure, and believe me, she was in the midst of pressure, have we not all, in the midst of pressure, said things that were wrong? Have we not all said things that were inconsistent with devotion to God? In response to what she said, Job said, I believe he said, honey, you speak as one of the foolish women speak. He didn't say she was a foolish woman. That's not what he said. He said, you speak as one of the foolish women. In other words, honey, you're talking just like those who do not know God. And she was. But have we not all? Have we not all had moments when we thought, when we talked, and we acted like we didn't know God? Well, we've had many of those moments. So is it fair? Is it fair to Job's wife to take this one incident in her life and judge her whole life? Before you do that, before you paint her as an evil and wicked woman, be consistent and apply the same judgment to yourself. In Job, or Job answers the question with the question, which reveals the mindset, I believe, of Job's wife at this time. He said there, shall we not receive good at the hand of God? And shall we not receive evil? That is, honey, you rejoice when God sends good. Does he not have just as much right to send evil into our life? I believe those words reveal that at this moment, Job's wife had forgotten the goodness and the blessings of God. And before you say, well, how could she? Have we not all? Have we not all at times become oblivious to the goodness and blessings of God. And as a result, we said stupid things. That's what she did. She said a stupid thing. Because for a moment, she wasn't thinking about the goodness of God. She was just simply thinking of everything that had happened. And she spoke. In this moment, Job's wife spoke and acted in a way that certainly was not pleasing to God. And certainly was not helpful to Job's spirituality. This added to the burden of Job. But again, I ask, have we not all? In time of great pressure, have we not all said and acted in a way that was not pleasing to God? And that was not spiritually helpful to others? Again, don't misunderstand me. I'm not condoning what she said. What she said was wrong. We are not excusing what she said. We are not minimizing what she said. We are not justifying what she said. But I believe it is absolutely wrong to take one incident in a person's life and pass judgment on their entire life. And that's what most have done. That's what most have done with Job's wife. Again, we have all, especially in time of trial and under great pressure, we have said things that we should not have said. And if we didn't say them, we thought them. Things that are just contrary to God. Things that are contrary to God's love for us. And in those times that you said those things, would you want your entire life judged by a misspoken and ill-advised word in a time of trial? Would you want your whole life judged by that? If you got news that all your children were dead, they've all been killed, and your immediate response was not what we would call godly, would you want your whole life judged by your immediate response to that tragedy? Would it even be fair to judge someone's entire life because of their initial reaction to a tragedy? Don't judge someone's initial reaction to a tragedy. If you want to be fair, you look at their life several weeks, several months after that. But don't judge them by their initial response. And don't tell me that if you got news today that you know for sure, that if you got news today that all your children were dead, that you know for sure you'd fall on your face and thank God. There ain't anybody here that can say, I know I would do that. Job did. That's very rare. That's very rare. There isn't a one of us here that can say, well, I know how I would react. No, you don't. No, you don't. I'm afraid that most of us would react the same way Job's wife reacted. Consider the duress that she was under when she spoke these words. Again, we say this not to excuse her words, not to justify them, not to minimize what she said at all. If you pick up a commentary on the book of Job, almost every single one of them will say that Job's wife spoke these words with anger, spoke these words with bitterness. Some have even said that she spoke these words with sarcasm. And some have gone as far to say she spoke these words in profanity. Now, I don't know whether she did or not. But, again, have we not all had times when we said things that were contrary to God? I do know this, for sure, that when she spoke these words, she was bewildered. She was confused. Her head was spinning. And she said something that she shouldn't have said. And she said something that was wrong. And she said something that was contrary to God. But instead of just looking at her words as a result of anger, as a result of bitterness, as a result of sarcasm or profanity, have you ever stopped to think that maybe what she said was said out of brokenness and not bitterness? There may not have been any bitterness, but no doubt she was broken. Did you ever stop to think that perhaps what she said was out of anguish and not anger? It doesn't excuse what she said. It doesn't justify it. But there's a big difference between saying something out of anguish and saying something out of anger. Big difference. Perhaps what she said out of suffering and not sarcasm. Out of pain and not profanity. When she said to her husband, "Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die." In other words, Job, are you still going to worship God? There's nothing to live for. Nothing. She was in a deep valley. Not just a valley, she was in a dungeon. She was in the most fierce and the darkest storm of her life. She was under extreme pressure. She had a load that she could not possibly carry. And I don't believe she was a wicked woman. I don't believe she was an evil woman. But I believe under this heavy load, in a moment of weakness, she said something that she should not have said. She said something that was wrong and contrary to God. Have we not all had those moments of weakness in which we said that which just wasn't so? How many times we've thrown up our hands and said, "Oh, what's the use?" Isn't that just like saying, "What's there to live for?" That's a foolish statement. That's a very foolish statement. That's a wrong statement. But would you want your whole life judged by a moment of weakness when you made such a statement? And I believe something that people seem to forget as they preach anything out of the book of Job is suffering in the shadows is Job's wife. We hear all about the sufferings of Job. What about the sufferings of Job's wife? Think about her for a minute. Job was a wealthy man. Chapter 1, verse 3. You know what that means? That means his wife was a wealthy woman. Job had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses. Were they not hers too? Yes, they were. They were married. They had a great household. It means they had luxury. They had conveniences. They had servants. Was not all that hers too? The property they had. The livelihood they had. The financial security that came as a result of those things. That wasn't just Job's. It was hers too. It was hers too. And when all the material blessings of God were taken away and destroyed, Job wasn't the only one that suffered loss that day. Job's wife did too. She suffered loss. Don't forget the sufferings of Job's wife. We also read that Job and his wife had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And one day word comes, they are dead. And I do not underestimate in any way or minimize any way the sorrow that Job must have felt, the hurt, the pain, the pressure, the anguish that Job must have felt. I've never experienced the death of a child. I have been with those who have. And I have seen the sorrow, the hurt and the pain. And you can't even begin to imagine the sorrow that they feel. And we do not underestimate or minimize the terrible feeling that came upon Job perhaps when he went to his eldest son's house and saw the ruins, saw the place where his children perished. And I don't underestimate and I don't minimize the sorrow that Job must have felt when he buried his children. And that day when he walked out of that cemetery from 10 graves, I don't underestimate his sorrow one bit. But don't forget Job's wife. Don't forget Job's wife. She was the mother of 7 sons and 3 daughters. In most cases, and this is not an offense to men, it's just the way it is, a mother has a closer connection with her children than a father does. And she has a love that is different. I'm not saying she loves them more. She has a love that's different. She has a love that is far different. When we read concerning those children of Job and his wife, they are dead. These were her babies. That's the way a mother looks at it. I'm a father. I don't look at my children as my babies. They're grown, they're out of the house, and I thank God. But mothers don't think that way. They're my babies. Can you imagine? All 10 children have died. And I'm not saying that Job did not feel sorrow. But these were Job's wife's babies. They were conceived in her womb. They fed at her breast. They rocked on her lap. And she was their nurturer in a way that Job never was. And in most cases, again, no offense to men, this is the way it is, the mother is far more of a nurturer than a father. This is true of Job's wife. And when she heard those words, they are dead, It was as if her heart was ripped out. Don't forget that all the while that Job is suffering, don't forget that suffering and weeping in the shadows is his wife, is Job's wife. Don't forget her. Don't forget her. In our text, we see Job sitting in the ashes. Again, I realize that what I'm saying tonight is not the way most people look at this. But I believe it's a way we need to consider looking at it. We see Job sitting in the ashes. Perhaps on this day, Mrs. Job, is wondering where Job is. So she goes out and she's looking for her husband. And as she looks out, she sees him there, sitting in the ashes, with infectious, rotting sores all over his body. He's in so much pain. He's in so much agony as he scrapes himself with those broken pieces of pottery. Think about what she saw that day. Just think about it. I know today I can hardly stand going and visiting my dad because he's not the man that I knew. Tears my heart out every single time. But think about Job's wife. Just think about what she saw that day. There's the man that she loved so dearly. The one that she's been with long enough to have 10 grown children. The one that she's shared her life with. There he is, sitting in the ashes in agony. Her sweetheart, her soulmate, her companion. The one that she has depended upon. The one she has leaned upon. The one who's always been so healthy and so strong. And now look at him. He's sitting in the ashes. So much sorrow, so much pain, and so much anguish. So there she sees Job, her husband. On top of everything else she has experienced, she now sees the shell of a man that she knew, with these boils from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. Was she not in a valley? Was she not in a storm? Was she not under great pressure? Was not her heart breaking? Was she not confused? And I believe at that moment, you can believe what you want, but I believe at that moment she lost it. And she said what she said. She couldn't handle anymore. And she said what she said. You say, well, she should have gotten down in the ashes and praised God with Job. Perhaps that is right. But how many are going to do that? Are you going to do that? You don't know. Probably not. If you get word tonight that one of your children have died, I will not judge you by your initial reaction. If you fall all to pieces and you say things that just aren't so, you need to cut someone a little slack. Amen. At times like that.
Don't you dare. When something like that happens, and somebody says something that's just not so, and it's stupid and it's ignorant, don't you judge the rest of their life because of what they said at that time. Your day may be coming also. And I believe it's a huge mistake to judge Job's wife for this, what happened here. Well, we read in Job 2 and verse 9, I believe, again, I realize there are some who perhaps don't. And those I've heard preach it, I know they don't. But I believe that this was a moment in her life and not her life. I believe that. And we all have moments, but it's not our life. We have moments. And she said something that I believe she probably later regretted. Something that she was probably ashamed of later. Something she repented of later. And I believe it was something that she emerged from. She came up from it. Notice in closing, Job 42, verse 12. In verse 10, it says, the latter part of the verse, that the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. In doing so, did he not give Job's wife twice as much? In verse 12, so the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. Is that not so of Job's wife also? And he goes on and talks about the material blessings. In verse 13, he had also 7 sons and 3 daughters. Someone might say, well, you're making an assumption that he's still married to her. Perhaps he's got a different wife. I believe if that was the case, God would have said so. But because I simply read that he had 7 sons and 3 daughters, I believe that he had them with his wife. That takes a while. 10 children. I believe in that time she had gotten over Job 2 verse 9. She's gotten past that. She's repented of that. Thank God that God does not judge my entire life by a misspoken word. Thank God that he does not judge my entire life by my initial reaction to a tragedy. I've seen people just about lose their mind. And they'll say, why? Why, God? Why? Why did you do this? That's not the right thing to say. But don't judge someone on their initial reaction. Give him a little slack. I believe Job's friends could have learned that. As soon as Job said the wrong thing, they were all over him. They were all over him. And Job said some wrong things. He said some things that, just like Job's wife, it just weren't so and just wasn't pleasing to God. But God blessed Job and his wife. You know what that tells me? That tells me that God is long-suffering. I am so glad. I am so thankful that God doesn't let me have it every time I say or think the wrong thing. I'm so thankful that he's long-suffering. So be careful When you read the Word of God and you read somebody like Job's wife, be careful how you judge Job's wife. Peter's another example. Peter did some dumb things. And he really did. And he denied the Lord three times. But you look at Peter's life as a whole, that's not what defined his life. That's not what defined his life. Be careful. Be careful how we paint people when a tragedy comes in their life and perhaps they don't handle it like Job did. There aren't many that do. There aren't many that do. Be careful of how you paint that person. God help us all. Brother Larry, if you'd come and lead us in verse 7.